One of our new members at the end of the Inquirer's class said, if you had to make a capsule summary of what the most important principles in the congregational faith are, what would that list be like? I listed three things: the autonomy or independence of the local church, the right of private judgment in matters of faith, and the mutual affection and respect that are essential in a church that grants that much freedom. I'd like to review them quickly, not so much for these 24 as for others who may need a brief refresher course, and for any of our welcome guests who might like to know what we are like. The autonomy of the local church means, in practical terms, that the members of this church make all decisions affecting its life. We call our own minister, resolve our own problems, plan our own future, sink or swim depending on how much we care, how deeply we are loyal. That kind of freedom has, like everything else, advantages and disadvantages. While our independence keeps us from being hamstrung, even pestered at times by an outside hierarchy, it also makes it harder for us to make much of a national splash in case we feel strongly about some social or political issue. We are simply one small church, tending to our own business, trying to help in our own community. We haven't the clout that is possible for churches with national headquarters and public relations experts and one or more national journals, but we like the freedom of deciding things for ourselves. So, a church governed by the congregation and by no one or group higher than the congregation, that is one of the bedrock principles of our faith. And the second, I said, is the right of private judgment. If this were not true, instead of the one evening this group and I spent together, we would need to spend weeks, even months together, learning a catechism, going over every item of faith and interpretation to be sure each member was properly programmed. We would need to study Christology, exactly how do you think about Jesus of Nazareth, what is the approved number of times for communion, what is the one correct mode of baptism, on and on through a long list, to be sure nobody got into the church who had a different conviction from anybody else on a significant matter. We don't do that because we believe that a genuine faith arises out of honest, personal conviction, unhindered by authority or pressure. You are expected to care enough to create your own personal creed. A congregational minister shares his own insights, passes on what he learns from his reading and experience, but you are free to accept or reject as you will. The atmosphere is open. I never try to suggest that what I am presenting on a given day is the only way to look at something. I do not quiz incoming members on how they feel about the resurrection, whether physical or spiritual, about the virgin birth, the miracles, the second coming, the nature of the Holy Spirit, whether prayer is objective or subjective. If I had come with a list of questions for the incoming new members, they would have gone something like this: Does the discovery of truth excite you? Instead of indoctrination, being told how it is and expected to accept it without question, do you like the idea of having beliefs, convictions, interpretations presented to you for your consideration, not in a shout, which is the manner of authoritarianism, but in quiet conversation, which is the manner of open discussion and free choice? Inevitably, what this means is that a congregational church will represent a wide diversity of views on different religious topics. So how are the people held together? What is the cement? And the answer to that is the third and perhaps most important bedrock principle of all. We have to respect each other genuinely, and we have to love each other. Now, love is a word that has fallen on bad times, used sloppily to mean a wide range of sentimental, slushy stuff that embarrasses intelligent people, but not the word translated love in the New Testament. Agape is grounded in the rational will, not in changing emotion. What that means is that you can love somebody that you don't like. Liking and not liking are emotional responses, gut reactions, automatic responses of one personality to another. It is inconceivable that every member of this church would like every other member. But it is essential to our life and mission as a church that you all love one another. And that you can do because agape, Christian love, only requires you to do the right thing for another person, whether you like her or him or not. Is it possible for me to dislike you and still care about you? To do, when I have a choice, what is best for you? Absolutely. I have sometimes admitted, I don't like that man at all. But if there were an election to determine his fate, and I had a vote, I would check the square that guarantees his happiness. Now, the divine sense in this definition of love is that if we treat a person right, whom we do not like, there is a strong possibility that the treatment will produce changes in him and in us that make us end up by liking one another. Sounds strange, doesn't it? That we love some people we can't stand until we wake up one day liking them as well? It happens. And it is probably the whole point of the Christian community. Now for a moment, I'd like to review our covenant more carefully than I have ever done from this pulpit. It starts out in the name and spirit of Jesus Christ, by his authority, and with his disposition, we become the church. In sermon after sermon, we try to define that disposition. Tolerance, mercy, kindly justice, love of the beautiful, abhorrence of hypocrisy and pretense, spoken to you week by week in the conviction that if you really pay attention, you can grow in mind and heart. Call it spirit if you wish. As much as the two SS men, Stallone and Schwarzenegger, grew in physical size and that you can do it without additives, just by hearing thoughtfully and then going out to practice. But the practice is essential. The covenant we make says that the Christian faith affords our clearest insight into the nature and will of God. But notice first what it does not say. It does not say that Judaism affords no such insight, or Buddhism, or Hinduism, or Islam, because any of us who have read know that they do. We say only that we have gotten our clearest, fullest insights from the Christian faith, which may mean that this is true because we haven't deeply studied anything else, or that we have studied other religions, but we still feel brought closer to God by the Christian faith than by any other. And in that open but demanding freedom, we join with one another to worship and work so that peace, justice, and brotherhood may prevail in the world. Now, those words may go by too fast. Worship and work. Some work without the elevating power of worship. Some worship without ever translating what they feel into lending a coat, writing a check. Peace, if we mean it, then we care right now about whether Gorbachev means it, whether Arafat means it. We're glad the Cubans have promised to leave Angola, even if they are doing it only because the Russians have said, get out or we will cut off your allowance. We take it any way we can get it, so long as the way is not dishonorable or useless, because we are workers for peace. That's what our covenant says, and since most of us are not likely to be diplomats abroad, that means working for peace on the city and county commissions, where the good Lord knows we often need it. Peace in the office, in the neighborhood, in our own houses, which may be the best place to start. Justice. Caring about fair treatment for people. Is someone being wronged, unduly favored, unfairly punished? What a disappointment if we should have no passion about such things. I know churches that sit around and debate about what the unpardonable sin is for weeks, and five doors down the street, someone is being grossly mistreated. If you make this covenant and walk by this covenant, you will care about justice. And finally, brotherhood, which goes beyond justice, which in its caring goes beyond what people deserve, which says, all right, there is an injustice here. If the law can't remedy it yet, I will do what I can to remedy it myself, because this is my brother who is being hurt. Those were not just words we recited together. They define the agreement by which we live together in this place. They point to concrete realities, to good things which we mean to support, to bad things which we mean to oppose. No church can realize all its goals, but every church is shaped by the goals it sets. And in this covenant we make together, we find our goals. We take a quantum leap in physical growth on a day like this, whether we match it in strength of character will depend on how seriously and how persistently we remember what we agreed upon together this morning.